reinstatement and 60 hours pay for 54 hours work.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the other day, we were talking with Clay Pope, former state representative out in Oklahoma, about just how bad things are getting out in his neck of the woods as climate change is really just causing farmers fits. But, you know, the good thing about what Clay was talking about is, you know, it's easy to be down. It's easy to be, you know, oh, there's nothing we can do. Clay had some very, very sound policy ideas on how we move forward. And today, the Center for American Progress came out with what I think is a really good set of policy ideas, a direction maybe that we should, I don't know, maybe think about, because I know there's a lot of people going, well, you know, if it's going to happen, nothing I can do about it. Yes, there is. That's why I've asked Trevor Higgins to come talk with us. Trevor is the Director of Domestic Climate and Energy Policy there at the Center for American Progress. Trevor, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. I'm happy to be here.
So, you know, it's easy to look at this as, you know, well, this global problem that, you know, what can I do? It's easy to go, well, you know, if it isn't happening to me right now, it doesn't exist. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist, right?
Yeah, that's right. No, climate change is here, and I think people are seeing the effects of it. And, you know, it's exciting. I think that a lot of the states have started to take that energy and turn it into real legislation. And so what we tried to do in this report is to say, you know, here's what all the states have accomplished and how we can translate that success to the federal level. As long as, you know, I think the most important thing an individual person can do is to vote. And if people vote for climate action, put it at the top of the agenda, I think we have a real shot at translating those state policies into real federal legislation that can actually take a stab at fixing this problem and avoiding the worst of climate change.
Now, you've got this this new thing out, 100% clean future. You know, as I was reading through some of the bullet points and some of the ideas, you know, I couldn't help but come back to, you know, this voting thing, because we have an administration right now that believes it's a hoax. It's a hoax brought on by China. I mean, you think of all the conspiracy and all of the misinformation and all the nonsense that's coming out. And, you know, it's hard to have hope at this moment that anything can possibly be done at the federal level.
Yeah, it's been an extraordinary thing watching them systematically dismantle everything that Obama accomplished on climate policy, and to take apart our, you know, the Paris Climate Agreement to the degree they can, to change, to upend vehicle emission standards, to overthrow the Clean Power Plan, and like none of those things were perfect. They were all works in progress.
Right.
But this is a place where he's been successful in his policy agenda is dismantling our efforts to deal with climate change, and it's a real shame. But, you know, there's still plenty of hope left because, you know, we don't have a lot of time, but we do have some time. And I think there's a pent-up demand to respond to all of those kind of, you know, terrible policy reversals. And yeah, Hopefully it can be the top of the agenda to fix those things.
Yeah, I actually had a listener send me an email after they went after the light bulbs. Because, you know, you remember when the light bulb was a big deal? They're taking away my light bulb. And Trump, I guess, undid all that. A guy actually, you know, emailed me and said, I can't wait to get my incandescent light bulb back. And I'm going, the old light bulbs aren't coming back. You know, they're just not.
Right. Yeah. And the fact is, like, they were still being sold until recently. And it was really that the demand for them collapsed because the new light bulbs are just better.
Yeah, you know, but again, you know, we get stuck in a certain way, and it's hard to move forward out of that. So, you know, in looking at some of your ideas and, you know, how we do some of this stuff, how hard is it going to get people to get on the train when, you know, we're creatures of habit?
Sure. Well, so the good thing is that the transformation that we're talking about has to happen over 3 decades, which
is not a long time.
Short. It's super short. But from the perspective of any individual person, it doesn't mean you have to go give up your car today. It doesn't mean that you have to suddenly like rip out your heating system in your house. It means that we have a shot, as long as we're putting the right incentives in place, to phase these changes in so that people's lives kind of go forward at their normal pace. And next time you buy an air conditioning system for your house, you might get one that's also a heat pump and that can run heating on electricity. And it will cost you no more money. It'll work just as well. And it'll mean that you have a clean source of power to heat your home instead of natural gas or whatever you might have. And that's the sort of technology transition that we tried to lay out here through policy to make sure that those options are available to people in a cost-effective way so that it's not a question of how much do I have to tighten my belt or what do I have to give up. It's a question of just choosing the right next step as you go through this.
Right. So you're not talking You're not talking about getting rid of cars and airplanes and no more, and we're still going to be able to have hamburgers and stuff like that, right?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, just think about how quickly, iPhones displaced, your rotary phone. Like, that was 3 decades. Maybe not the rotary phone part, but the phones have only been around for a short while here, and that transition happened quickly. And you could imagine the same thing happening. I mean, we started to see it with solar panels in the electricity sector, and you could imagine the same thing happening with electric vehicles or heat pumps or whatever it might be that will kind of unlock the ability to continue living your life without all of the greenhouse gas emissions.
Right, but doesn't this ultimately come down to policy, policy initiative at the federal level? Look, I know states are doing some really great things, but ultimately, doesn't this have to come down from the federal government saying, hey, this is the direction we need to go in?
You're totally right. It's not really about personal choices. And as much as the states are doing great things right now, the benefit of what the states are doing is not so much that their emissions are being reduced. It's that they're creating a market for the new technologies, and they're demonstrating what policies work and which ones don't and which ones work best. And that's the thing that's valuable, because then the federal government can take that and say, here's how we're going to transform the electricity sector and the transportation sector. And here's how we're going to support technology deployments in the manufacturing sector. And here's how we're going to pay farmers to do climate-smart agriculture. And here's how we're going to plant new forests to kind of draw down historical emissions. And that's all going to happen at the federal level.
You know, because your report points out, there are no silver bullets in there. There's no quick fix to this. So it's one of these all-encompassing things, top to bottom. I mean, there's no quick fix here, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think there's a lot of good things that we'll be able to do, but it's not like we're going to come in and snap our fingers and outlaw climate change. This is going to be a patient, long program of change in a lot of different places. And the fact is that can be a little scary. Like, if you say it that way, it kind of can scare people. And that's why it's got to be part of a big comprehensive program. You can't just do one piece. You have to have everything moving along all at once. And that means the energy changes and the industrial practical changes and trade policy changes and international diplomacy changes and policies that guarantee workers a seat at the table and provides them jobs in their home communities, and policies that deliver emissions pollution reductions in communities that have borne the brunt of refineries and highway exhaust, and gives people something to tangible benefits they can understand why this broad program works for them and how they fit into it.
Yeah, but ultimately, and I've heard this as part of the climate debate for a very long time, that we need to go after the communities. And what you're talking about are the poor communities who have been abused over the last 40, 50 years, by having all the dirty economy in their backyard and all the factories and all that stuff.
Right.
Getting them to buy in probably isn't going to be as hard as getting the people who are the entrenched interests who are making huge amounts of money off of the current economy that you're already telling them from the start they're really not going to benefit from.
Yeah, sure. There's definitely vested interest in doing things the way they are right now, but we're going to have to overcome that. And ultimately, I think there's a lot of business interest in getting ahead of the technologies and being ahead of that transition and making the smart investments that are going to pay off. So it's not a monolithic opposition here. It's really just the fossil fuel industry that has to decide what its future looks like in a world where we're transitioning away from complete dependence on their product.
Right. I remember, I'm taken back to Rex Tillerson when he was the head of ExxonMobil, who said, the climate change is real. It's nice to hear someone say that, you know, especially someone who was in this administration. But you know, we're gonna figure it out. We're gonna adapt. We're gonna use technology, which means that they know they're gonna end up profiting from it down the end, which gives me some hope that, you know, maybe even ExxonMobil gets it.
Right. Yeah. They've started investing small amounts in things like biofuels and hydrogen and other technology solutions that they think they could play a role in, and that's promising. I think they need to do more of that, but it's a good step.
Yeah, I mean, because at the end of this, you know, while it's all great to talk about policy, especially for, you know the communities who have been impacted most and in the most negative ways by our current policies, it's great to talk to them. But ultimately, this is going to come down to the people who are sitting in rooms that we don't even know where the doors are that they're sitting behind.
Right.
So it's going to come down to the big money buying into this as well. At least I think so. Am I wrong?
I think it depends on the results of the election. The degree to which they get to negotiate, I think there will be a part of it, but that there are also, you know, that the voters get a say here. And if everyone makes it a priority, we're going to be in much better shape for negotiating an outcome that works for everybody.
Now, are you seeing, you know, in polling data that we're getting it? Because I'll tell you, I've run into, I guess we've polarized on this issue like everything else. I find very few people who go, I don't know. There's the crowd who goes, it's all a bunch of bunk. Because look, when I grew up, we were worried about the planet freezing. You know, when I was a kid, it was all about, you know, we're going the wrong way, and the next ice age is coming. And then you've got the people who think, you know, this is the most important. We got to do this today. Chuck everything else. I find people are already pulled into those two camps, those polar opposite camps. Is there any middle ground, I guess, is where the thought is?
Yeah. No doubt everything's very polarized these days, but this issue actually is starting to see some movement in like the last 2 years or so. And, you know, we ask people, are you more concerned about Democrats' plans disrupting the economy because they're trying to deal with climate change? Or are you more concerned about Trump's policies exacerbating climate change and the effect that has on you? And it was many more people were concerned about climate change than they were about what the economic transformation would look like. And that doesn't mean we can ignore her. I mean, it's because we got to take care of the economic transformation. But the real story there is that people see what's happening with climate change. I mean, take a look at California right now. Part of the reason why there are hundreds of thousands of people without power right now is because our parents' generation didn't do enough to avoid climate change. And now it's here. And we haven't done enough to adapt to it. And that's PG&E doesn't have systems in place and the technology in place to remotely understand what lines are doing or to predict the weather closely enough or to create microgrids. So we have to invest in all of that now to deal with the climate change that's already happened. And if we don't start cutting our emissions in an enormous way and get to net zero globally in 30 years, it is going to be so much worse than the wildfires we're seeing in California right now. And it's going to hit everyone all at once. And I think people are starting to grasp that.
Yeah. Is it possible? You think it's really possible that in 30 years you can get everyone in the globe to buy into this? I mean, you know, I'm looking at, you know, the geopolitical situations that are going on right now. And I'm going, man, if it's one thing to get this country moving in one direction, but to get the entire globe going in the same direction. I don't know. I'm hopeful. I hope my kids have a sound future and their kids, my grandkids have a sound future. But man, I don't know.
Yeah, sure. With something that we're concerned about, too. And so when we sat down to write this paper, we fought really hard. We didn't want to come up with a paper that just said, here's how we fixed U.S. emissions. Because while that's significant, I mean, we're a huge part of the emissions globally, much larger than our population would suggest we ought to be. But by itself, it's not enough. So how do you translate the success we're trying to build here into international action? And what we came up with was a whole program of how you use not only diplomacy, not only rejoining Paris, but having direct bilateral negotiations with China, with India, with the European Union to lock in place ever stronger ambition. Plus, when they don't want to come along, we can use our trade authorities to protect domestic industry, promote clean exports, and drive them to be more ambitious in their tools. And the United States, the third part of our plan here, is about finance, because the United States has a unique role not only in the public government financing of projects overseas, But in the way that the huge portion of the financial industry of the world is located in the United States, subject to U.S. regulations. And so if you can put together the U.S. influence on all three of those points, the diplomacy, the trade, and the finance, we are the country more so than any in the world that can bring the rest of the world along with climate action. And the good news is largely they're ready to do it. We're the only ones who aren't part of the Paris Agreement right now. And so when we rejoin, it's going to be a huge shift in momentum.
So basically what you're telling me is this next election, while I'm thinking this next election is one of quite possibly the last of our democracy if it goes the wrong way. But you're saying that now you want to heap on top of this election. It could be the future of the planet depends on this election. Am I hearing this right?
I agree with that. We don't have much time here. We have to cut emissions by more than 40% globally in 2030. So if we miss this election and then we're only starting in 2025 to make those reductions, it's just not going to be possible. We're going to have locked in so much climate change that our job will be a lot harder, a lot more painful. So this is our next best shot here to hit. I think if we miss this opportunity, the idea that we're going to stay below 1.5 degrees of warming, which is a threshold that the scientific consequences of are really horrifying, this is our shot.
Well, I hope this election goes the right way. I keep saying that, but again, I'm not hopeful. Last question I've got for you, because you know ultimately this you talked about the change of the economy, and you know I'm thinking about the Industrial Revolution and all the chaos that happened around that, especially the pain and suffering for working people as we moved from an agrarian society to an industrial one, and all of those that major shift that took some 80 years for the country to adjust to. We're talking about this major undertaking that you're talking about, plus the effects of what automation is going to bring on the workforce. We're talking about really tumultuous times. So, in this, I'm glad to see that there's some talk about making workers whole and ensuring that there's something of a transition that helps them. How do you reinforce that so people may want to go, hey, look, I'd like us to do better, but my job in mining or the extraction industries or oil or whatever are directly affected by this. How do we transition that message to make sure that none of the workforce is really left behind?
Yeah, right. I'd say that the economy is always changing, and the automation is a major new thing that's coming. And we've already seen how market shifts can leave behind industries like the coal industry, and which was put out of business almost because of fracking, which is like a new technology that developed out of nowhere and came on the scene so quickly.
Well, it didn't come out of nowhere. I mean, they've been doing it for a very long time. It's just we haven't been doing it.
Right. But it came on suddenly, right, and then caused this shift in the market is what I meant.
Right.
And those transitions are always happening. And when we're looking forward and we can see that even greater transitions are coming, to me, it's an argument for being hands-on and saying, you know what, we're going to manage this change aggressively and assertively so that it goes in the direction we want it to go. We're going to protect people against automation. We're going to create new opportunities in new industries. We're going to anticipate what the promising new clean technologies are, and we're going to invest in those. We're going to do it in a way that's geographically smart so that it's near where the workforce already is. We're going to provide training. We're going to partner with unions to do it. And you have to put together this whole program, and that's going to be an ongoing work. So what needs to happen today is the clear promise of that. And I think the candidates are making that promise, and hopefully everyone will be able to hold them to it when we actually get to the point of implementing these changes.
There's the key, holding them to it, holding them to their promises. You're absolutely right. Trevor, I appreciate you taking time for us. Good stuff. I hope people will take a look at the report, 100% Clean Future by the folks over at the Center for American Progress. We'll get links out to make sure people are able to take a look at that. Trevor, thanks so much. Appreciate the time.
Thank you.
I'd love to hear your thoughts. Is this imperative? Is something we need to be doing now? As I believe it is, or is this, it's just another thing to maybe try and get us to act in a certain way. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
saving work in America, one show at a time. The